Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The number of IDPs, or people internally displaced by the conflict in Sudan, has more than doubled in just the past week, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, warned on Tuesday. More than 700,000 people have been internally displaced since the fighting erupted on the 15th of April. Here's IOM spokesperson, Paul Dillon.
IOM wishes to acknowledge the overwhelming generosity of the Sudanese people and their communities who have opened their doors to IDPs arriving in their areas, but we're also conscious of the enormous pressures that this places on families, on host communities, who themselves, in many cases, are already suffering from the effects of more than 3 weeks of fighting.
The violence has been compounding humanitarian needs in a country which had already been experiencing high levels of displacement. Prior to the conflict, there were 3.7 million IDPs in Sudan. Humanitarian access remains difficult in the country, and most UN agencies and their partners have been impacted by large-scale looting, the spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on Monday in a statement condemning the latest such incident, which targeted the main compound of the World Food Programme in Khartoum over the weekend. Haiti needs urgent support from the international community to stop the suffering of people at the hands of violent gangs, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, warned on Tuesday. In the month of April alone, more than 600 people were killed in the country's capital, according to information gathered by the UN Integrated Office in Haiti. This follows the killing of at least 846 people in the first 3 months of 2023. Lynchings of alleged gang members are also on the rise, as vigilantes take the law into their own hands, the UN Rights Office said. Mr. Turk reiterated his call on the international community to deploy a time-bound, specialized, and human rights-compliant support force with a comprehensive action plan to assist Haiti's institutions. He underscored that poverty and the lack of basic services were among the root causes of the gang's stranglehold over the country, and stressed that vigilantism will only fuel the spiral of violence. Staying with human rights, the frighteningly high number of executions this year in Iran prompted UN Rights Chief Volker Turk on Tuesday to call on the country's authorities to abolish the death penalty or halt all executions. More than 10 people are put to death each week in Iran, Mr. Turk said, making the country one of the world's highest executors, with at least 209 people put to death since the beginning of the year, according to sources quoted by the UN Rights Office, OHCHR. Executions are carried out mostly for drug-related offenses. Mr. Turk said this was incompatible with international human rights norms and standards. OHCHR said that minorities were overrepresented on Iran's death row, and that according to sources, at least 45 people, including 22 from the Baloch minority, were executed in the last 14 days alone. Speaking before the Human Rights Council last month, Mr. Turk had called the death penalty a relic from the past that should be shed in the 21st century. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day. Here in Kansas, we have a late start on the show today due to the crazy weather that came through here last night, yesterday afternoon, and last night especially. But it was an amazing evening. All kinds of hail damage in southeast and south central Kansas, eastern central east. Went through very quickly. However, it lingered in some spots, but it was multiple supercells on this wide-ranging front that came through. Hail damage was reported as far south as Pratt, Kansas, and down our my old stomping grounds of my youth, Leroy, Neosho Falls, Westphalia, all those areas were hit with some pretty heavy-duty weather. And condolences to the property owners and the people whose houses were damaged and vehicles were damaged. Coming up in the second hour, let me find it here. It's got the TUC promo, and always something coming up is great to check up on. Here we go. So I was loading last night in the middle of this storm, and I was like, what the hell? This is an unusual PUC Radio.
Land back is a new conversation. I like to remind them that it's actually hundreds upon hundreds of years of discussion, activism, movement, that Native people throughout all nations have been, since the beginning, talking about what it would mean to reclaim and rebuild their lands, their ceremonies, their water, their fish, their acorns, their food.
Dr. Katja Wisling Baldy on the next podcast of TUC Radio.
Which comes up in the second hour following Alex Smith's radio Eco Shock. And right now, this morning's headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A New York jury unanimously found former President Donald Trump liable for the sexual abuse and defamation of writer E. Jean Carroll, awarding her $5 million in damages. The jury, however, rejected a rape charge. During the trial, Carroll recounted her sexual assault by Trump in the dressing room of Bergdorf Goodman in the 1990s. Since it was a civil trial, Trump was not convicted of a crime and does not face prison time. Trump's lawyer said he would appeal, while the ex-president called the verdict a disgrace and said, "I have absolutely no idea who this woman is." In a statement, E. Jean Carroll said, quote, "Today the world finally knows the truth. This victory is not just for me, but for every woman who has suffered because she was not believed." We'll have more on this story after headlines and speak with one of the witnesses in the trial, Jessica Leeds, about her experience of Donald Trump sitting down on a plane and sexually assaulting her. CBS News is reporting the Biden administration is expected to publish today new procedures for quickly deporting migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border ahead of the lifting of the Trump-era Title 42 pandemic policy Thursday. President Biden said he expects the situation at the southern border to become chaotic. The new rule would require the majority of asylum seekers to request refugee status in another country like Mexico before reaching the U.S. Deported migrants will be barred from re-entering the U.S. for 5 years. Earlier this week, 233 groups, including the ACLU, Amnesty International USA, Detention Watch Network, and RAICIS, sent an open letter to President Biden demanding he follow through on his commitment to never detain migrant families, end for-profit immigration jails, and to allow people to live with dignity in their communities while their cases are being resolved in court instead of being locked up and surveilled. The groups write, quote, "Detention places people in conditions known to cause mental and physical harm and endanger their lives. Detention is not a deterrent to migrants who have no choice but to flee dangerous or violent conditions in search of a better life," they wrote. Meanwhile, immigrant justice groups in Texas held protests in Austin Tuesday to demand lawmakers reject HB 20 and HB 7. Which would deputize vigilantes to carry out immigration enforcement in Texas and create a parallel court system to try migrants and smugglers picked up by state-run patrols. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy remain at a stalemate over debt ceiling negotiations after meeting Tuesday for the first time in 3 months. The two agreed to meet again as the U.S. inches closer to a possible default as early as June 1st. McCarthy has demanded spending cuts before agreeing to raise the debt limit, which Biden has refused to consider as Democrats slam Republicans of economic hostage-taking. Biden spoke after Tuesday's meeting.
"Everyone in the meeting understood the risk of default. Our economy would fall into a significant recession. It would devastate retirement accounts, increase borrowing costs. According to Moody's, nearly 8 million Americans would lose their jobs, and our international reputation would be damaged in the extreme."
Calls are mounting for President Biden to invoke the 14th Amendment, which would allow him to continue issuing debt bypassing Congress. Biden has said he has not taken that option off the table. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot dead two Palestinians during a raid in the town of Kabatia. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip continued for a second day, with at least one Palestinian killed today after the air raids killed at least 15 Palestinians and wounded 22 others Tuesday, according to officials. This is a shop owner in Gaza.
It's a hard situation, to be honest. We face fear. We are staying tuned. We don't know what will happen. The situation is, everyone doesn't know what will happen, whether we are going to have a war or ceasefire.
In Ukraine, French journalist Armand Soldin was killed in a rocket attack Tuesday in Khasiv Yar near the war-torn eastern city of Bakhmut. The 32-year-old journalist worked for the AFP news agency. The Committee to Protect Journalists says he's the 15th reporter to be killed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year. In more news about the war, the head of the Russian mercenary Wagner Group said President Putin's troops have started to abandon their positions in Bakhmut. This comes as Britain's poised to designate Wagner as a terrorist group. France's National Assembly approved a similar measure Tuesday and urged the European Union to follow suit. In Pakistan, nearly 1,000 people have been arrested as protests broke out following the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan Tuesday. His supporters gathered today as Khan made another appearance in the Islamabad court, where he was indicted for selling state gifts during his premiership between 2018 and 2022. A court yesterday ruled his arrest was lawful as his legal team continued to fight the charges. Former UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn called Khan's arrest a dark day for democracy. Authorities have shut down social media sites while a judge is set to rule on a request for permission to detain Khan for at least 14 days. This is one of Khan's supporters.
What they have done, is this not hooliganism? Is this not terrorism? Imran Khan had gone to appear before court. Now where is Supreme Court? Where is High Court? Where are the judges?
In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his main rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, have been holding massive rallies ahead of crucial elections this Sunday that could see the end of Erdogan's rule after more than 20 years in power. President Erdogan announced Tuesday his government's raising its workers' salaries by 45% in a bid to counter voter concerns over Turkey's ailing economy amid soaring inflation. Erdogan also is facing continued backlash over his response to the catastrophic February earthquake and damning reports of lax building regulations and neglecting warnings about the safety of structures.
Let's talk the truth here now. My whole family is gone. They are all deceased. Why wouldn't I be angry against the government? No machinery came to help. Nothing did.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is backed by a multi-party alliance, has vowed to pursue closer ties with NATO and the European Union, reinforce democratic institutions like independent courts and a free press. He also said he would reverse Erdogan's dissolution of the position of prime minister in the 2017 constitutional referendum.
We are not going to leave the fate of the Turkish Republic in the hand of one person, and no one will accept the words of just one person.
Conservative President Erdogan has also appealed to his religious base, accusing his opponent of being pro-LGBT at an Istanbul rally Sunday. Back in the United States, embattled Republican Congress member George Santos is expected to appear in a New York court today after federal prosecutors file criminal charges against him. Details of the charges are not yet known, but the New York congressman has been under investigation for his many lies around his campaign financing, biography, education, and work history. Santos has defied numerous calls to resign. Separately, a hearing in Brazil is scheduled for Thursday over charges Santos committed check fraud. In California, a state reparations task force approved recommendations on compensating and apologizing to black residents for generations of discrimination and violence from slavery to the present day. Congressmember and U.S. Senate candidate Barbara Lee, who's helping lead a congressional push for reparations, spoke at the meeting Saturday in Oakland, which she represents in the U.S. House.
Reparations are not a luxury for our people, but a human right long overdue for millions of Americans. Millions of Americans. A promise of 40 acres and a mule made to formerly enslaved people over 150 years ago has yet to be filled. And it's critical that the promise be made that was made to our ancestors many years ago is kept. And the process of truth-telling and racial healing, that's got to be carried out also. The atrocities committed against black Americans are undeniable. And reparations are a tangible route to acknowledging and making amends
If the measure is approved by California's legislature and Governor Gavin Newsom, it will provide monetary compensation to black residents for discriminatory policies, including mass incarceration, policing, housing discrimination, health care inequalities, and environmental racism. In labor news, service employees, international union workers at the union's headquarters in Washington, D.C., have authorized a strike as they continue contract negotiations for better wages and protections. Many walked off the job Tuesday as employees accused the SEIU president, Mary Kay Henry, and the secretary-treasurer of supporting union-busting tactics and refusing to negotiate in good faith. Paramount Global is laying off a quarter of its staff and shutting down MTV News. Head of Paramount Media Networks Chris McCarthy made the announcement to employees in an emailed memo. Paramount's also the parent company of CBS, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, and Showtime. The latest media layoffs come after massive job cuts at Vice News, BuzzFeed is closing, and other companies. And David Miranda, Brazilian journalist and the first LGBTQ member of the Rio de Janeiro City Council, has died at the age of 37. The news was announced by his husband, journalist Glenn Greenwald, on Tuesday. David Miranda had spent 9 months in intensive care after being hospitalized last August for a severe gastrointestinal infection. Tributes to Miranda, who also served in Brazil's Congress, poured in following the news. The Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, noted his extraordinary trajectory. Miranda, born in a favela and orphaned at the age of 5, continued to fight for Brazil's poor and the LGBTQ community, which came under renewed attack during the presidency of Jair Bolsonaro. NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden also paid tribute to Miranda, celebrating his courage and righteousness and helping bring his leaked documents to light in 2013. Miranda was notably detained for 9 hours at London's Heathrow Airport, but refused to cooperate with authorities. Snowden wrote, "It was that courage that set him free," unquote. David Miranda is survived by his husband and their two children. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
Two centuries ago, the world was fully renewable, but at the time, it was 1 billion peasants. So a 100% renewable world, I know at least one option. We will go through a contraction of the economy because we will go through a maximum in the use of fossil fuels, and renewables will compensate for a small fraction, but not for the whole.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We have a special treat for you this week. The world premiere of an English-language in-depth radio interview with Jean-Marc Jancovici. Jean-Marc is well-known in Europe and beyond as a consultant in both energy and climate change. He is an author of several books, the latest being Sleep Quiet Until 2100 and Other Misunderstandings About Climate and Energy. Jean-Marc founded his company, Carbon 4, and an NGO called The Shift Project. Jancovici is also a member of ASPO France, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, or l'Association pour l'étude des pics pétroliers et gaziers. I'm Alex Smith. Let's do it. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Did you know energy is free and peak oil is not so dead? That comes from a French expert in technology, energy, and climate, Jean-Marc Jancovici. Jean-Marc co-founded Carbon 4 Consultancy and The Shift Project. He advises, writes books, and lectures, mostly in French, but his ideas resonate with American writers like Richard Heinberg. From Paris, Jean-Marc Jancovici, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning or afternoon, I don't know.
It depends on where you are in the world. You seem to say we cannot continue to live with fossil energy, but we can't continue to live without it either. What do you mean?
Actually, when you look at what happened during the last two centuries, which, by the way, was most of American history, you realize that what people have done is that we shifted from energy converters that were mostly hard bodies and domesticated animals and firewood and wind, that is renewable energies, to energy converters made of metal, that is engines. And these energy converters allowed to develop, actually they allowed to turn each of us into an Iron Man. And to multiply the amount of transformation that we can each perform by a factor, let's say 200 in the world, 1,000 in the US or 2,000 in the US. So what energy did actually is that it gave the food to machines, new food, food that came below the ground when renewable energy comes from on the ground or above the ground, food that came below the ground to feed new slaves that don't think, that don't complain, that are perfectly moral, that are machines. And actually, industrial times is going from renewable energies to fossil fuels with a little extra, namely nuclear, but it's a small amount in the world. And that allowed to multiply by several hundreds the ability to produce something, that is to transform matter for each of us. That's basically what happened during the last two centuries, and wherever this happened, the society evolved like. Namely, when you look at the way the day-to-day life changed either in Europe or in the US or in USSR before Russia and then Russia again, or in Japan or etc., there is a very simple rule, which is tell me how much energy you use, and I will tell you the way you live. Because, again, energy is machines and machines, or energy is transforming, actually. It's in physics, it's what quantifies transformation energy. So there is something that happened during these historical times, something very specific, never happened before. It's the ability to increase by several hundred the physical flows that surround us. But this relies basically on fossil fuels. And fossil fuels, they are well named, they are fossils, or actually they are They come from fossils. Fossil fuels, namely oil, gas, and coal, are all remnants of ancient life. For coal, it's old ferns that lived 300 million years ago. And for oil and gas, it's basically algae and plankton, wherever it existed, that lived any time between 50 million years ago and 400 million years ago. This ancient life, that was marine life, part of it, well, actually all of it died. Part of it became sequestrated below the ground because of tectonics. Then it became, it got the heat, the inner heat from the earth, that kind of distillated that organic matter, and it turned it into oil and gas, some of it becoming trapped by reservoirs. This is, by essence, not renewable. Actually, it's renewable if you can wait 100 million years, what we don't do. But in the course of historical times, say a couple of million years, it is not renewable. And there is a very simple math theorem that says that when you pick into a non-renewable stock, that is a stock that you cannot renew, it's given once and for all, the extraction from that stock is going to start at zero if you go far enough in the past. That's minus infinite. It's going to end at zero if you go far enough in the future. That's plus infinite. And in between the two, it's going to pass through an absolute maximum. That's the peak. And actually, that theorem can be applied to anything which will never be renewed. So we can apply it to oil. We can apply it to gas. But we can also apply it to nickel, iron ore, copper, aluminium, just name it. So whatever comes from a mine has to go through a peak. The only questions are actually, will we trigger the peak or will we suffer from the peak? Is it something that we are going to decide and manage, or is it going something that we won't decide? It will just happen. Is it potentially far or not far from where we are? Is it at a very high level or not at a very high level from where we are? And actually, for a couple of resources, it's already behind us. So we might even ask ourselves the question, what are already the visible consequences of the fact that we are past or post-peak? So fossil fuels, now 80% of the energy supply, that is the fleet of machines that we use, are so efficient that they have replaced renewables, and we won't be able to replace them by renewables again, because that's, we have precisely done the opposite in the course of historical times. So the present standard of living just cannot be physically sustained without the help of fossil fuels for physical reasons. Again, they are incredibly dense, incredibly powerful, and that's why they have turned each of us into Iron Man. The economic counterpart, so to say, of that increased power is that the price of anything has gone down by tremendous amounts. If you take the U.S., for example, in 1930, food was 25% of what people earned. If you go to a supermarket today, the bill will be the bill for food. I mean, what you pay at the cashier will be 5% of what you earn. But within that amount, what you pay is mostly building the supermarket or now Amazon, whatever, building the packaging, paying the truck that brought the food, etc. And the food itself is going to be 2% of what you earn. And among that 2%, you eat 4 to 5 times more meat than 80 years ago. So the real price of food has been divided by several tens. And that actually can apply to anything that we buy today because we have put machines to work instead of people.
I watched a YouTube video of your English language lecture in Paris delivered in January 2018. It's called, Can We Save Energy, Jobs, and Growth at the Same Time? You savaged the idea that we can live a similar life as today using only renewable energy, and that's odd to hear from a person who has helped advise governments on environmental policy. Why can't we have the good life with renewables?
Well, there is something in your question which is not true. I don't advise governments because governments are not advised. They respond to external pressures. The first external pressure they respond to is elections. Then there is permanent ongoing pressures which come from what we call lobbies. But lobbies actually can come from both sides. I mean, Environmental Progress is a lobby. Environmental Defense Fund is a lobby, as well as the Union of Chemists or whatever. So what governments do everywhere in democracies, it's not exactly true in other regimes, but in democracies, what they do is that they respond to external pressures. Right now, the president that you have is not doing anything else, or he's not doing anything different than what Obama did, only he's not responding to the same pressure, or not serving the same people. The reason why I say this, again, is for physical reasons. It's not possible to keep the same flows. So when you look at something that a productive activity, what is a productive activity? It's transforming resources into manufactured products, and that's true even for services. If you look at Netflix, for example, Netflix to exist needs cables, computers, electricity production. It needs trenches to bury the cables. It needs satellites that must be launched by rockets, etc. All this is material. I mean, all this is material. All this requires mines. All this requires fossil fuels. All this requires metal industries. All this requires chemistry. So all this is material. And actually, when you look at the footprint of a laptop, for example, producing a laptop is emitting 0.5 ton of CO2 into the air. So the idea that today we have services that don't require material inputs is totally false. Actually, when you plot the fraction of services into employment versus energy consumption, you have something which is a positive correlation. Actually, the more energy you use per capita in a given country, and the higher the fraction of services into employment. So what we are witnessing today is a civilization in which we have terribly increased the physical flows, including in services, and that can be done only with fossil fuels. And again, what we have done in the course of the last 2 centuries is coming from renewables. Again, 2 centuries ago, the world was fully renewable. But at the time, it was 1 billion peasants. So 100% renewable world. I know at least one option to achieve it. It's to go back to 1 billion peasants with a life expectancy at birth that was something like 25 years or 30 years, let's say. But 100% renewable world in a world with 7 billion people living like even a minimum wage worker of a Western country, that is just simply not possible. I mean, if you do the maths and look at the rule of three, you just can't figure a way to achieve this. Now, once I've said this, what is the practical conclusion? The practical conclusion is that it will decrease a way or another. And actually, if you look at Europe, Japan, and even to some extent the U.S., all these countries have gone through an absolute maximum of their energy supply in 2006. In my view, it's what triggered what we call the subprime crisis. The subprime crisis is actually triggered by an energy crisis. with a spike in oil prices in 2008, but it's not a matter of price, it's a matter of volume. So the volume of oil that came into these countries after 2006 decreased, and that triggered a contraction of the physical flows, that is, the economy, and that triggered an economic crisis. So anyway, we can put it whatever we want. We will go through a contraction of the economy because we will go through a maximum in the use of fossil fuels, and renewables will compensate for a small fraction, but not for the whole. Same thing for nuclear. I advocate for nuclear, and I think that in this context, calling on nuclear is something that globally avoids risks and not globally creates risks. But it's not going to avoid the contraction of the system. It's going to soften it if we call on nuclear. So, and in my view, it's a good idea to soften the contraction.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with French expert in energy and climate change, Jean-Marc Jancovici. So you have talked about energy as a background cause of the 2007-2008 financial crisis, and elsewhere in your work, you've offered the energy supply as a solution for many other things, including, you say, Brexit is a direct consequence that the energy supply has begun to decrease in Europe. And that seems counterintuitive to me because there really isn't an energy crisis in the Middle East right now, but people are coming out of Syria and other countries. How do you explain that statement?
For the statement on Brexit, from 2006, the energy supply in Europe begins to decrease. When you look at the energy supply in Europe, so again, the food for the fleet of machines, but people that listen to us must understand that from now on, every time they come across the expression energy consumption, they must replace it by fleet of machines. That's what they must keep in mind. And then plenty of things become crystal clear. So from 2006, the energy supply in Europe begins to decrease. Why? Because 80% is fossil fuels, and these fossil fuels are the sum of coal, and coal is on decline regarding production in Europe since the early 80s. And it's not easy to import coal in massive quantities because the logistics of importing coal is a nightmare. You must have dedicated harbors, dedicated trains, dedicated boats, and it's not something that you can increase in the blink of an eye. So coal decreases. Then gas that is used in Europe is 60% coming from the North Sea, and the North Sea passes through its peak in 2005. And again, importing gas is not something that you do into the blink of an eye because you have to build pipes, and building pipes takes a long, long time. You probably know it in the U.S. with the Keystone XL pipeline. And GNL that you can bring by boat is something that accounts for 10% of the world gas consumption. So it's not something which changes by and large figures. So gas production in Europe declines, and so gas consumption in Europe declines. And oil imports, oil production in Europe began to decline in 2000 in the North Sea. And oil imports in Europe began to decline in 2006 because from 2006 to 2012 or 2011, say, there is a long plateau on the world oil production, even if you include condensate. And so the ability to import of the historical importers, including US, decreases because China, namely, and India take more and more of the existing oil. So what happens is that oil plus gas plus coal are all on the decline. And so the energy supply in Europe declines. So the ability to operate a large number of machines declines. That means that the GDP declines because euros or dollars, whatever, or pounds, they are just the economic way to count a transformation that the physicist can count in joules or British thermal units. So what happens after 2006 is that the industrial production and the GDP in Europe begins to decline. But Europe is a big market. In this big market, Romanians earn 300 euros per month. People in Hungary and people in Bulgaria and people in Poland, all these people earn far below 1,000 euros, so say $1,000 per month. Whereas in UK or in France, people earn much more than that. So what happens if you have a free and open market where you have no GDP growth overall, but still the ability to go wherever you want? Well, it happens that Poles move to London, and it happens that British industries close their factories in Great Britain and invest in Romania, as French industries do, as everybody else does. To name it with, I would say, words used by physicists, you have a global amount that doesn't change, in which you have huge differences of potential that soften, that get level. So what happens is that money flows from the West to the East. And then you ask the Britons whether they are happy with it, and they say no. And exactly the same way, you ask the Italians whether they are happy with it, and they say no. Exactly the same way, the Germans begin to say a little no. And in France, we have also a populist party, which is growing. And I believe that in the next elections, that will be the European elections next year, we'll have a huge no also coming from the French population. And that's due to the fact that Europe, a single market, that thought its future only in a context of growth. Nothing is foreseen in the case there is no growth. So what happens, and actually that's something which is valid for many democracies, a future with no growth is something that so many people consider as unthinkable, including all these economists that get the so-called Nobel Prize in economy, they believe this is so unthinkable that nobody thinks on what to do if it happens for real. And actually, that's exactly what we experienced in Europe. The U.S. experienced exactly the same thing. I'm not sure that many people that will listen to us know that that to date, the absolute maximum for the U.S. energy supply was 2005. Today, the U.S. is still below. And actually, the GDP went up again. But when you look at the structure of what went up, you have the inflation of assets that accounts for a large fraction of what happened. And the fact that you have full employment is also due to the fact that the number of people that got out of the labor market during the crisis never came back to the market. So today, we are still in a situation in which we haven't recovered, so to say, from the 2006 and 2007 situation. And if you look at the chronological order of what happened, in 2006, maximum in the OECD zone of the energy supply, at the end of 2006, you see a deceleration in the GDP growth, and you see the real estate prices that begin to decline in the US, and that triggered all the rest. So it's not the fact that people in the finance industry have done nonsense, which is true, by the way. It's not the fact. It's not sufficient to explain what happened. Now for Syria and other countries alike, we have witnessed a combination of an energy crisis and climate change. The energy crisis that I've just mentioned deprived Egypt and Tunisia of tourists. There are no tourists in Syria, so there's something else that plays a major role. Tourism in these countries accounts for 10 to 15% of the GDP. And these countries are otherwise major importers of food because they have a domestic population growth, and the domestic production of food cannot follow because of droughts, basically. I mean, it's not possible to grow enough food. And actually, droughts are increasing in the Mediterranean basin because of climate change. So these countries have to import plenty of food. Now, in 2010, we're in the aftermath of the energy crisis and therefore the economic crisis that I've just mentioned. So tourists are gone. These people need to import food. But tough luck, that year, food prices skyrocket for two reasons that add to each other. The first one is that oil prices rise again, and you have a correlation between all commodities on financial markets. So basically, when the price of oil goes up, the price of anything else goes up. And it's not because of inflation; it's because of the way asset managers act. And the second thing is that that year you have a huge heat wave with a huge fires and wood fires, and a huge contraction on the cereal production in Russia. And Russia that year says that it won't export cereals. So that's another reason for which overnight in July, I remember, the prices of cereal went up 30%. And these countries, Tunisia and Egypt, again, are massive importers. Tunisia roughly imports half of what the population eats. And Egypt is the largest wheat importer in the world, and it imports about a fourth of the cereal it uses, and then oil, whatever, meat, and plenty of other things. So what happens then is that prices of food go up, and they go up over what, let's say, the 30 or 40% of the population that are at the lower end of the bracket can afford to buy food. And so you have food riots. And as you probably know, if you have read history, food riots is a very good way to get rid of existing powers. It's also what happened in France in 1789. Just the year before, there was a huge hunger that killed almost a million people, and that triggered the French Revolution. So that's what happened in these two countries. In Syria, we have something close. The population of Syria and the food production of Syria grow alike until 2006. And then from 2006, under probably the increasing droughts in the Mediterranean basin and under the rise of the price of oil that prevents people from using too much machinery in the fields and too much water pumps, the food production begins to decrease. And Syria basically is not connected to the outside markets, cannot import anything because basically it doesn't export anything. So also you have all these people that move to the cities, and it adds on top of a situation that was already highly unstable. So of course it's not the only reasons that triggered what happened, but it directly contributed, energy and climate change, to what happened in Syria. And my belief is that all these are the early signals of what is going to increase around the world because of energy contraction and climate change.
You know, Jean-Marc, the energy peak oil movement and the climate change movement grew up as separate and then sort of discovered each other later. And there was quite a bit of discussion as though there were a race of which was going to endanger our civilization first, climate change or peak oil. And I think after the fracking explosion in the United States, that fell somewhat quiet, and people have been ignoring the limitations on energy and thinking that we have enough fuel to power our way directly into catastrophic climate change. Where do you place your bets on which is the greater threat coming soonest?
I place my bet on the fact that nobody will understand for both of these factors that is happening. So actually, when you look at what is happening today in Europe, which is obviously the place that I know the best, nobody talks of the fact that we have contraction of the energy supply. Nobody does. Nobody understands that it's something that we haven't chosen. Because if it were something that we had chosen, it wouldn't happen the same year everywhere. Because politicians are not the same everywhere, domestic measures are not the same everywhere. So if it were something that was a consequence of domestic policies, it wouldn't happen in 2006 in Greece and in Spain and in Italy and in France and in the UK and in the US. I mean, it doesn't fit. But I do not see in Europe a single government saying, oh, we have understood energy is machines. If machines work less, the GDP goes down. That exists nowhere. I'm not sure that it exists in the US, and I'm not sure that it existed during the mandate of Obama. Correct me if I'm wrong. So my bet is that governments don't understand this, and I have not seen very often, if at all, in the head of a political executive in Europe, the fact that climate change is already putting refugees on the road by large numbers. So a little more, so to say. And my bet is actually, I'm going to answer your question with another question. Suppose you put a pair of scissors on one of your fingers, okay, with one blade up and one blade down, and you increase the pressure, and you ask yourself the question, which blade is going to do you more harm? I think your answer will be, actually, there is no, I mean, your question has no sense. I mean, it's the fact that they press one against the other, which is going to harm me. It's exactly the same thing with climate change and energy. Actually, energy is the ability to change things into the world. So with infinite energy, you can address any adverse effect without limits, because you can correct anything without limits. So what is going to harm us is the conjunction of limited energy and increasing problems. That's what is going to harm us. So it's the conjunction of the fact that climate change is going to increase and energy is going to not increase much then decrease, which is going to harm us. Let me take an example. Over 2 degrees, we will trigger the dismantling of the West Antarctic ice sheet. It's an ice sheet that relies on mountains, so there is a slope towards the ocean. And if the conditions become favorable, in quotes, so to say, that part of the ice cap is going to become unstable if we are on a path over 2 degrees. And once it has started to melt and dislocate, there is no going back because you have positive feedbacks everywhere. When that ice cap fully ends into the ocean, it's going to take a couple of centuries, but when it fully ends into the ocean, it's 6 meters extra for the ocean. We have the same process with Greenland. Actually, Greenland has begun to melt, and there also, because of the positive feedbacks, is going to continue melting for the centuries and millennia to come, and that's also 3 to 6 meters extra for the world ocean. So 6 plus 6, plus the fact that the ocean is going to rise because warm water occupies more volume than cold water, so the fact that water dilates when you heat it is going to add to the ocean level increase. So just wait if we go over 2 degrees, and one day Netherlands will be under the water. A significant fraction of Florida, a significant fraction of Louisiana, a significant fraction of New York, etc., all this will be under the water, including Bangkok and Shanghai. Well, you understand that to displace all these cities in the blink of an eye without fossil fuels is something that you just can't do. So it's the conjunction of the two, because in 5 centuries there will be no fossil fuels or very little fossil fuels. And today it's fossil fuels that allow to manufacture cement in large quantities, iron in large quantities, have trucks that bring all this in large amounts, cranes that allow to erect all this quickly, etc., etc. Notre Dame, that was built 1,000 years ago, it took a century to build it. Now a tower in Manhattan takes 6 months or a year. So this is because of energy. So what is going to hurt us, to end this long answer to your short question, is the conjunction of the fact that having less energy is something that means that we'll have less ways to master our destiny, and at the same time, we will confront to a growing climate change. And something that I should add, because it's something that many people probably don't have in their minds, the amount of time that you must wait for a surplus of CO2 to evacuate from the atmosphere is over 10,000 years. So there is nothing such as a reset button for climate change. The only thing that we are sure of is that the day consequences will become unbearable or perceived as unbearable, it will then become worse later on. It's the only certainty we have. So, it's a certainty we have. So, it's the conjunction of the two that is going to harm us, exactly as if you put the two blades of scissors on top and on the bottom of your finger. It's the pressure on both blades at the same time which is going to hurt you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to our discussion with a French expert in energy and climate change. From Paris, it is Jean-Marc Jancovici. So Jean-Marc, your latest book is Dormez tranquille jusqu'à l'an vincent et autres malentendus sur le climat et l'énergie. That is loosely translated as Sleep Quiet Until 2100 and Other Misunderstandings About Climate and Energy. Can you give us a short introduction in English to that work? What's it about?
It's about the fact that in the energy and climate change debate, and actually, I didn't answer a small part of your question, which is, indeed, the world of energy and the world of climate change were two worlds that didn't talk to each other for a very simple reason. It's that people the visible or the major NGOs into environmental issues were globally saying regarding the largest actors in the energy sector you are our enemies. And if somebody is your enemy, you don't try to understand what he or she does. So people that wanted to explain both what climate change is and what energy is, actually, we still are, there still are very few of us. I'm, for example, a member of ASPO in France, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Most people that come from the oil sector consider that people that are in the climate change sector are people that do not address the main problem. And most people that work in the climate change sector just don't know what an energy system is. So it's true that there are not that many people. It happens that my personal history made me coming across both of these topics, but it's something which is a kind of luck. I mean, it wasn't made on purpose. Now, to come back to the book. The book is based on the fact that because of the simplifications made by the press, people that debate on energy or on climate change issues most of the time debate on misunderstandings. The title of the book, Sleep Well Until 2100, actually was given because in the climate change issue, something that you most probably have heard all the time is if we do nothing, then we will have 3 degrees or 4 degrees or 5 degrees or whatever in 2100. And when you hear that 100 times, most people that otherwise are not specialists and their major issues are, am I going to get out of of my job early enough to pick up the kids at school? have I forgotten or not to buy bread this morning, and etc. When they hear this and they are not specialists, basically they develop a reflex of understanding that until the 31st of December of 2099, nothing will happen. Basically, if we risk something for 2100, there is an implicit in this sentence, which is that before that date, we risk nothing. So the title of the book was there to recall that, of course, things will happen before 2100, and it's not because people that perform simulations in climate change, in the climate change debate, using numerical models, perform their simulations until 2100, that nothing is going to happen before. It's a little less true now. I mean, the debate has progressed a little because things are becoming true. I mean, things, you're not going to learn that California has witnessed its largest, or some of its largest wildfires in history last summer. So something is becoming real. So now people understand that 2100 was only a conventional date in the numerical models used by physicists. But a couple of years ago, I mean, my book was written in 2010, it was not true. Among the other misunderstandings that I develop, or that I try to address in this book, there is the fact that I developed before, that the 2000 crisis is not before anything else a financial crisis. It's before anything else an energy crisis, actually a double energy crisis. The first trigger was pulled in 1973, might recall it, the first oil shock, because that was a sudden change in oil production that before that date was growing by 8-9% per year in the world. And just after that, it fell to plus 1% in the world on average for the 30 years that followed. So that sudden change in the energy supply, well, in the oil supply, triggered a sudden change in the energy supply, and actually it triggered the stop of the growth of the energy supply per capita, that is the machine fleet per capita, in all OECD countries. Therefore, to be able to continue to spend money at a growing rate of 3 to 4% per year, because the system that were installed in all the Western states was to spend money, and namely public spendings, with a growth rate of 3 to 4% per year, you couldn't sustain this unless you began to borrow. And so external debt began to exist and grow, but exist in some countries. I mean, France didn't have any external debt in 73. It began to grow from that date. And then in 2005, a second thing happened. Oil growth in the world stopped, and the oil supply in OECD countries began to decrease. And that hit hard because of the contraction of the GDP that followed. A stockpile of debt that began to grow until the first oil shock. So what happened in 2008 is a double energy crisis, 73, then 2005, and it is not primarily a financial crisis that we will fix with financial fixes, and then the world growth can go on as it did before. It is not going to become true. And actually, we have now all the early warnings of a new crisis coming along, because the shale oil boom that you just mentioned in one of the previous questions is coming to a halt right now. You probably know that in the U.S. there is a bubble on the debt of shale oil frackers. All these people, they don't earn positive cash flow. So they have a little problem reimbursing their debt. And you have a kind of Ponzi pyramid that is being built on this sector of the economy. So right now, there is another huge misunderstanding still. It's that energy is a sector in the economy and not the blood of the economy. So that's another thing that I addressed in my book. Another one, I've just discussed it. It's the fact that the riots that happened in Tunisia and Egypt in 2010 were riots for democracy. It was not. It was riots for food because of energy and climate change issues, among other things. I'm also discussing the Brexit and the fact that in France, our populist party is also our own domestic Trump, I could say, is also gaining audience. All this is a consequence of the fact that the European GDP came to a halt for energy issues, etc. So all this that I'm developing into this book is the fact that if you take your energy glasses to look at what's happening, plenty of things become logical and connected, but also very, it makes you very anxious. But then you understand that we are embarked on a course that we won't halt in a week. I mean, something which is governed by very long-term trends, and it's going to be very difficult to reverse the trend with, I would say, short-term measures.
Yes, Jean-Marc, what do you make, you mentioned the sort of Trump in France developing. What do you make of the withdrawal of major polluting countries from climate change action as the United States even withdrew from the Paris Accord and the rightist leader probably going to be elected in Brazil is claiming he will do the same? How do you see that playing into this picture we've just been talking about?
The first answer that I'm going to give you is a historical one. Between 1965 and 2017, the CO2 content of a dollar of GDP in Europe was divided by three. In the US, that, as you know, didn't sign the Kyoto Protocol, that pulled off from the Paris Agreement, by how much do you believe that CO2 emissions per dollar of GDP were divided in the same period? The answer is by three. So my opinion is that what these political leaders do is of basically no importance. What is important is what people that really, or I'm going to be more precise, it is important, but it's not the main driver of what is happening. What is the main driver of what is happening is what large corporations will do, is what citizens will do, is what local governments will do, is what trade unions will do. I mean, elected presidents are one among many of the actors that have to and that can play a role. You see, for example, in the U.S., the fact that the CO2 emissions coming from electricity production decreased over the last 10 or 15 years has nothing to do with Obama and actually nothing to do with Trump. And when Trump says that he's going to revive coal, I mean, he can just as well tweet on something else. He has no influence on what is happening, because what is happening today in the U.S. is that producing electricity with shale gas costs less than producing electricity with coal. That's why coal is going down and gas is going up and the CO2 emissions coming from electricity production are going down. It has nothing to do with Obama and nothing to do with Trump. So the importance of having a political leader saying, I want to be in or I don't want to be in, is something which is not the only, reason why things happen. Let me ask you a question. Suppose that tomorrow morning, both Europe and Japan and the U.S. have major economic actors that say, we all have a vested interest in the fact that the Amazon forest remains in good shape. So we are ready to pay people to keep the Amazon forest in good shape, because if we don't do this, the world climate goes haywire, and we don't want it. And we are going to establish a flow of money going to people that are going to do something, I would say, sound with the Amazon forest instead of cutting it to grow soybeans. Do you think that the Brazilian president is still going to be a climate skeptic? I doubt it. So basically what these people do is that they respond to external pressures, just as I said before. This guy actually has no conviction by himself. He just doesn't care. He has voters. He has lobbyists. And that's what drives his action. If tomorrow morning he can understand that he puts his country into a better shape, caring of the issue than not caring of the issue, he will do it.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock with our guest Jean-Marc Jancovici. You know, I've been thinking about how sad it is in a way that your work is walled away from us, most of it, by language differences. And again, there's so much good work in German that is closed off to me. But eventually, and maybe not too far away, machines will accurately translate your book to English. And in fact, the barriers to world languages will fall. Now, would that start a new intellectual revolution, or could it be dangerous as well if everybody can talk to everybody anywhere?
Ah, that's a good question. I think it does actually. I'm going to give you two answers. I think that as a whole, the world IT and telecommunication system is an emission enabler. It is an emission enabler in two ways. One way, and that's going to be translated into English, it happens that the NGO that I have created 7 years ago, the SHIFT Project, that basically advocates going to a low-carbon economy because it's a good idea to do so in the long term. Basically, it's the economic optimum in a way. We have to preserve assets that are indispensable to preserve a productive system. Even though in the productive system, we never take these natural assets into account. Without them, we just cannot produce. I mean, if tomorrow morning you put somebody into the interstellar vacuum with no resource, even though he has trained and skilled workers and a very nice banker, he won't produce anything. So if you don't have resources, you don't produce. So preserving resources is something that you need in order to preserve a productive system. So in the long run, actually, advocating for a low-carbon economy is advocating for something that it can be sustained in the productive system. Otherwise, we won't sustain anything. So going back to what I said, so the SHIFT project just released in French, but it's currently being translated. So if you're interested, it will be my pleasure to send it to you once it's translated. A work that we have performed on the carbon footprint of the world IT and information technology system. That's the combination of personal computers, servers, networks, cables, telecommunication lines, satellites, etc., and the electricity that runs all this. Well, if you pile up all this, so including production of the device that we use to run the global telecommunication and IT system, it amounts today to 4% of the world emissions, which is globally about the emissions of the world truck fleet. So this, and it's growing by 10% per year. So the first way to answer your question on IT, if I understood correctly that it was a question on IT, is that notwithstanding what Apple and Google say, today the global IT system is an emission enabler because it is a sector that leads to emissions because of the upstream mines, because of the upstream chemical industries, because of the upstream metal industry that is required to manufacture all the device, and because of the coal power plants, 40% of the electricity in the world, and the gas power plants, 25% of the electricity in the world, that are required to operate all this, even though some people say that they operate on 100% renewable electricity, which is not even true, but it's okay. Now, the second thing for which it is an emission enabler, I'm going to demonstrate it by the absurd. Suppose that tomorrow morning, all the IT system vanishes. All the computers vanish overnight. All the telecommunication lines vanish overnight, etc. What happens? We have no money anymore, because money today is basically something written in a computer, as you probably know. Banknotes, at least in France, I don't know what it's like in the US, but I suppose it's close. Banknotes and coins, it's 1/30 of the global monetary mass. So you're not going to run the economy only with this. You have no communication system, so all large organizations cannot run anymore. You have no water pumps, so all the cities are deprived of potable water. They are deprived of what comes out in the toilets, name it. It's evacuated elsewhere. You're deprived of cops because cops cannot operate without communication system, etc., etc. So basically you have a collapse. And if you have a collapse, of course CO2 emissions will contract. So this little demonstration by the absurd shows in a very simple way that today the global IT system in the world sustains huge flows and therefore a huge use of energy. So the idea, and your question on whether it was a good or a bad thing that everybody can talk to everybody else is actually something that cannot exist if you do not have a global IT system. Okay? If you do not have that, it just cannot exist. So the good thing right now is that the global IT system will enable me to talk to a fraction of your audience that might regret it. But for sure, it is something, the global IT system, which pushes the emissions up instead of pushing them down. It's uncomfortable to hear, but unfortunately, it's a fact.
Yes, although, and we don't really have time to get into the other side of my question, which is perhaps it's better that we are all isolated in separate language or tribal streams. And once we really are able to talk to each other, perhaps that would allow some central power to offer propaganda to all of us in a single language. I mean, we don't have time to go there. But I would like to ask you, you said in your Paris lecture of January 2018, because the energy at large doesn't grow, anything that someone wins is something someone else will lose. It sounds very Darwinian. Your vision makes us almost a secondary agency, not only to machines, but to energy itself. And I got this picture that billions of us have almost evolved like insects to become fossil fuel parasites. Is that too dark or is that true?
What do you mean? I'm not sure I got the question.
Well, you have just explained all throughout this talk how totally dependent we are on fossil fuels at this point.
Yes.
And, you know, without them, I would say billions of people would die.
Yeah, probably.
So we can say, in a way, we have changed from whatever natural animal we were to now become very complex fossil fuel parasites. We have to live off this other food.
Parasites. Yeah. In a way, yes. We are fossil fuels symbiotic animals.
Yes.
like the mushrooms that depend on the tree.
Exactly. All right. Now, what are you working on next?
Just a couple of things. As you said at the beginning, my work is to be a consultant. And actually, I'm the founder of a company that now amounts to a modest 50 people. And we try to confront economic activities to the energy and climate constraints, basically. I hope that before I die, a significant fraction of the budget today devoted to McKinsey, Bain & Company, the Boston Consulting Group, and Harvard economists gets devoted to my company, because we try to put physical limits into the business that will happen anyway, and it's probably helpful for people. So that's my tremendous professional ambition, I should say. With the SHIFT project, my ambition is to try to convince people that have the time to listen to complex explanations, just like the people that listen to us right now, that we have something which deserves much greater attention, because all the rest is correlated to that, or linked to that, and that if you take going low carbon as I would say the root of a political program, It's something which is holistic, and you can plug all the rest on it with something which is very easy to explain and very easy to advocate. So that, I would say, is my associative ambition. Now, regarding books, unfortunately, nights have become too short. So my editor has been trying to convince me for the last 4 years to write a new one. But I don't know when I will be able to say yes to him. But if I do so, I'm not sure it's going to be very, very good for my clients. But if I do so, I think that the next one, I would like to do it on greenwashing. Because one of the things that dispels me is that the complacent behavior of most of the media today that accept the greenwashing of the companies that otherwise finance the advertisement budget, so finance the media, and they accept that to, I would say, relay the light put on solutions that treat 1% of the problem and a full silence on the rest. And that's something that you can witness everywhere. I mean, all companies, they come with a corporate speech that says, we're addressing the issue, look at what we're doing, we're doing this and that. And actually, when you do the math, they're addressing 1% to 2% to 10% of the issue. I've recently learned that the SP 500 companies in the U.S. are going to spend $1,000 billion on buybacks this year. And the CEOs of all these companies, right hand on their heart, are going to say that they really want to save the planet, and they're not going to spend 1% of this amount on serious actions to understand and address the issue. So probably if I do a next book, it's going to be on this huge, I would say, greenwashing and hypocrisy that we are witnessing today.
All these voices that whisper in our ear, sleep well until 2100, my darlings. So, from Paris, we've been speaking with the French author and consultant on energy and climate, Jean-Marc Jancovici. I will put links to his website and other materials in my weekly show blog published at ecoshock.org. Jean-Marc, it has been really stimulating talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Millions of us in the west of North America, Scandinavia, and Russia went through a summer of fear and smoke in 2018 as record forest fires filled the air. Was that a burst of carbon to the atmosphere? And what does it mean? Next week, I'll ask a widely known expert, Professor John C. Lynn from the Land Atmosphere Interactions Research Group at the University of Utah. Then we're off to England for another deep science interview with Dr. Edward Hanna from the University of Lincoln. There is something going on over Greenland that can steer hurricanes into coastal cities in the United States and Canada. Oh, yeah. And summer pressure in Greenland can rain out the UK and Northern Europe and change the sea level around the world. Be sure and tune in to Radio EcoShock next week. Sometimes a phrase can appear out of the fog. This week it is an old English saying, whistling past the graveyard. There are two ways to interpret this phrase. Wiktionary.org gives two definitions, and consider these as reactions to the horrors of climate change as well. To attempt to stay cheerful in a dire situation, to proceed with the task, ignoring an upcoming hazard, hoping for a good outcome, or to enter a situation with little or no understanding of the possible consequences. This all came to me reading tweets about Donald Trump. A tweeter named Puesto Loco said Robert Mueller should tell the voting public if current candidates are suspected of crimes or even treason. If not, says Puesto, Mueller whistles past the future graves. Isn't that what we do as we drive around and shop? As we vote for climate deniers because we like their other policies. As we whistle along through these fossil-powered illusions, the future graves may be millions on the other side of the world, or for our descendants, or maybe ourselves. Hey, it's a Halloween horror show here on Radio EcoShock. Check out my weekly blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. This is Screamin' Jay Hawkins, whistling past the graveyard.
Coming in on the night train with an arm full of boxcars on the wings of a magpie across a hooligan night. Busted up a chaperone way out by the Kokomo. Cooked up a mess of mulligans and got into a fight. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, top of one-eyed jack. You probably seen me sleeping out by the railroad track. Ask the Prince of Darkness about the smoke from the stack. Sometimes I kill a jackal and suck out all the blood. Steal myself a station wagon, driving it to the mine. A whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, papa, one-eyed jack. I know you've seen my headlights and the honking of my horn. I'm calling out my bloodhound, chase the devil out the corn. Last night I cracked the Mississippi, and now it's dry as a bone. I was born in a taxi cab, I ain't never going home. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, papa, one-eyed jack. My eyes have seen the glory of the draining of the ditch. I'm coming to Baton Rouge to find myself a witch. I'm gonna switch me a couple of them every time it rains. You gotta see a locomotive, probably think it's a train. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, papa, one-eyed jack. In my eye. I got a ring around my finger called the 4th of July. When I get lonesome, a tear falls from my cheek. There's gonna be an ocean in the middle of the week. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. Mean mother hubba papa, one-eyed jack. I come in on the night plane with an arm full of boxcars. On the wings of a magpie across a hooligan night. I'm gonna tear off a rainbow and wear it for a tie. I never told the truth, so how in the hell could I tell a lie? Twisting past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba papa, one-eyed jack.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Royal Mead, drunk men came hurrying through, while Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy.
Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
That's right. Saturday at noon here on Radio Free Kansas. Carl does a great job of mixing the board. Some very wide and sundry issues he addresses on the show. Again, that's every Saturday at noon here on Radio Free Kansas. Now coming up, Gloria Gillardin's Off the Grid production. That's where she lives in Northern California. Off the Grid. TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Northern California Land Back Symposium 2023 was a day-long event at Cal Poly Humboldt in Arcata, held on March 24. Panels discussed public and private land return, land grant universities, indigenous land trusts, and legal recommendations. The Land Back Symposium broke many taboos and told the story how a powerful movement of land return is spreading across the world and, at least in California, has even reached some support by state government. The opening session began with a welcome from Chairman Ted Hernandez of the Wiat tribe, followed by Geneva Thompson, the Assistant Secretary for Tribal Affairs at the California Natural Resources Agency, and ended with a talk by Dr. Katja Wisling-Baldy on land histories and decolonial land futures. Here's Regina Cicisola.
I get to introduce today our first welcome speaker, Ted Hernandez, Chairman Ted Hernandez of the Wiat Tribe. We're very glad that he could join us today to welcome us to Wiat territory here at Cal Poly Humboldt. We occupy Wiat lands. We are here in Gutdini or among the redwoods. We're very glad that we're able to have a really lasting and ongoing relationship with our local area tribes. All right, I'm going to bring up Ted Hernandez to do a nice welcome to Wiat territory for everyone.
Hello, Tina. Ted Hernandez. I am the tribal chairman for the Wiat tribe, as you know. Can we all just stand for a minute for a quick blessing? Dr. Godwell, Creator, I just want to thank you for gathering us all here today so we can share stories and we can learn from one another on how to get our land back, that we can honor you and celebrate the ceremonies that you have put us here on these lands to do. I ask that you watch over the ones that are traveling right now as we speak to make them here safely. And when they go home back to their lands, to help them get home safely to be with their families. Dr. Godwell, Creator, I just thank you for the elders that you give us to provide us our stories and our next generation, the younger generation, to continue the fight and the battle that we see. Dr. Godwell, Creator, I just thank you for everything you do for us, for the Wiat people and for all the indigenous communities, that you continue to bless us and continue to show us the right way to go. Dr. Godwell, Creator, just thank you for this amazing day and just watch over everybody today and just allow questions to be answered. And Dr. Godwell, Creator, I also ask that you open everybody's mind so they can see why we do this and see what the purpose is. Dr. Godwell, Creator, just thank you. Oh, thank you, guys. And I just want to say welcome to our homeland, Wiat country, and enjoy your day. I know we have a little rain right now, but it probably will start raining again, so make sure you have your umbrellas and your jackets, huh? Because Creator is washing this land, and he's taking care of us. So thank you, guys, for being here, and ho.
And we're really amazed and lucky to have the state of California committing to tribal land return. And with that, I would like to introduce Geneva Thompson. Geneva Thompson joined the California Natural Resource Agency in June of 21 as the Assistant Secretary for Tribal Affairs, where she works to ensure the participation and inclusion of tribal governments and communities within the work of the state Natural Resources Agency. She previously served as the Associate General Counsel for the Yurok Tribe, where she practiced environmental and cultural resource law and represented the tribe in the state, tribal, and federal forums. Geneva is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and enjoys beading, gardening, and hiking with her spouse in the state and national parks.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Regina. And also a huge wado and thank you, Chair Hernandez, for opening us up today and for the Wiat people for having us here on your lands. And so wado and thank you for having us. a huge appreciation for the invitation to join today's conference and the important conversation around ancestral land return. As introduced and as the Secretary mentioned, I'm the first ever Assistant Secretary for Tribal Affairs at the Natural Resources Agency. And it's an exciting role because I really do see that the state is trying to shift its practices, policies, and programs really to strengthen partnerships with tribes. And part of my role in that is to ensure that our departments underneath the agency umbrella, as well as all of the environmental and natural resources policies coming out of the agency, really integrates tribal priorities throughout those policies to ensure that we are taking a critical look at the historical wrongs that's been committed and then addressing those wrongs in the spirit of truth and healing. And the only way that we can truly do that is through early, often, and meaningful government-to-government consultation and really shaping those consultations and conversations we're having with tribes towards a collaborative partnership instead of a box-checking, letter-sending exercise that I'm sure many of you here today have experienced in the past. So that's an exciting part of the role, is really to think about how we can do better here at the state and then institutionalize those best practices and so it lives past this administration. We all know here in the room today, ancestral land return is a high priority that we've been hearing from tribes in our consultations and also as directed by Governor Newsom in his statement of administrative policy on ancestral land return. And that's a particular area and policy that we're really excited to roll up our sleeves on and focus our energies, monies, and efforts towards. A part of shifting our environmental and natural resources policies towards partnering with tribes is a good example of that is shown through our nature-based solutions work, including the development of two strategies, the Natural Working Lands Climate Smart Strategy and the Pathways to 30 by 30 Strategy, which if folks have a moment to look at those two strategies, you'll see tribal priorities are built throughout all of the goals and objectives laid out in those two strategies, as well as the core commitments to how the state implements those policies includes strengthening partnerships with tribes. And so all of the money that's coming out of the agency for these nature-based solutions projects have that core commitment to partner with tribes and are encouraging all folks who are trying to do and implement nature-based solutions projects, including the purchase of land, including for the conservation of property, should be working towards partnering with tribes. Another key component to our commitment to partnering with tribes is the establishment of the new Tribal Nature-Based Solutions Program, which includes $70 million that was appropriated by the legislature last September to fund tribal priorities, the big priority being that ancestral land return, and ensuring that there is money and support and policies in place to support tribal priorities in the nature-based solutions work. But wanted to share a little bit about what we're trying to do here at agency and really just express my deep appreciation for the invitation to be here with you all today, have this conversation with everyone, and also learn more from tribal leaders, cultural leaders, and the experts who have been doing this work, you know, well before I or the state of California has. And so, Wado, and thank you so much for the opportunity to join you all today for this important conversation.
Thank you, thank you. Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Charlie Reed, Education Director, Hoopa Yurok Kaduk person as well. And it is my honor to introduce you all to our next speaker, somebody who is a personal mentor to me as well as professional and academic mentor, Dr. Kutcher Risling-Baldy.
Hey, young Kiwit. I am Dr. Kutcher Risling-Baldy. I am the department chair and an associate professor of Native American Studies here at Cal Poly Humboldt. I'm also Hoopa, Yurok, and Kaduk and enrolled in the Hoopa Valley Tribe. Happy to be here today in this space, but also just in general, being able to talk about land back and really thinking about land back as something that can bring people together in a conversation about what the world is going to look like next. The work that we do as Native peoples is always to be thinking forward. We sometimes say seven generations forward. And I think in the context of land back, we're really thinking about our future generations. We're thinking about the way that we want the world to be and the way that we can work together to make the world rebalanced in a way that we've always talked about the world where we lived. I did an interview one time with a reporter about land back, and they asked me,
when do you think the land back movement began? And I paused and I said, 1493. I just think as long as we've been having to deal with this invasion of settler colonialism, we've been thinking about how are we going to rebuild the futures that we know need to happen here in these spaces. And it has been an ongoing conversation. So when people come to me and they say, land back is a new conversation, or it's become such a fashionable thing right now, or it's something everybody wants to talk about and it's brand new, I like to remind them that it's actually hundreds upon hundreds of years of discussion, activism, movement, policy, political interventions that Native people throughout all nations have been since the beginning talking about what it would mean to reclaim and rebuild their lands, their ceremonies, their waters, their fish, their acorns, their foods. It's not something that we stopped talking about. And I like to think about our peoples and the ways that they were navigating this attempted genocide of us, and that they, even through that, they were thinking about the futures. They were talking about what was going to happen on the days where we brought things back. They weren't talking about the end of us. They were talking about the futures of us, and they were willing to work as long as it took to make those things happen. And I think about that a lot as we start this conversation around land back. I think about what it means to just begin a conversation. What I always tell people is, in an Indigenous context, nothing can become until you story it into being. This is the way we begin everything, is with a story. When you start talking about it in a story, then it can come into being. It says, oh, they need me around. They want to have this conversation. And then things kind of happen from there. So when we start talking about land back, it's storying into being what the world could be. It's looking at the fact that we've been working for this for hundreds of years. And I want us to think about that in the context of the things that we're doing today. When they were talking about what is the future going to look like, when they were talking about the future seven generations, they were talking about us. We should also be willing to do the hard work that it takes to make land back possible, even if that's going to take us 50, 75, or 100 years. I get invited to a lot of places now to do land back talks. I think really what they want me to do is just be the person who comes in and is like, you should give all the land back. And then they can all like freak out on me. And most times people just freak out on me when I do that. When I come into a space and I'm like, you should give all the land back. They're like, freak out. I got invited actually to talk at a very fancy big museum one time, and they were like, can you come in and talk to us about decolonizing the museum? And I said, okay. So I came in and I was like, you want to decolonize your museum? They said, yes. I said, you should give all your stuff back. At the end of that, I was like, end of talk. Because it's like always people sort of like trying to kind of come up with reasons why it's not possible. And now when I get to go places and say we should give all the land back, they go like, what does land back even look like? And I'm like, I actually can show you. I can show you videos that have been made and reports that have been written. I can show you ways that people have given land back. I can tell you it doesn't look the same anywhere. And it's very specialized to what's happening in the space that you come from, but you should want to do that work, whatever that work looks like. I can also tell you it can sometimes take a very long time, but it to me is the first step. And sometimes people will say to me, well, so you start with like educating people or outreaching to people or talking about what it is. And I was like, no, we just give the land back and move from there. And then they're like, well, how do I do that? And I said, I don't know, just give it back. I just have this feeling I'm going to do these talks that I come into, because I call them inception. And I'm like, my job is to come in and just tell you, like, it's possible, it's beautiful, it's amazing, it's really cool. It's probably the best thing that you could do. It's the thing that's going to put you on the map. It's the thing that people are going to talk about. I give, like, the inspirational. I show them examples. I tell them what it looks like. And then I'm like, but it'll just sit there. And then when I went to one conference, I was like, what's going to happen is you're going to listen to me, and then you're, like, going to go get in your Teslas. And you're going to be like, that gave me a lot to think about. And then you're going to drive around for a while. And then maybe like 2 years from now, you're going to be like, I don't know why, but I'm still thinking about this thing that was said to me. And it's going to get in your brain, and it's going to just build and grow, because this is the place that we should have always started from. I tell students a lot, what's happening is we live in a culture and society where things don't make sense. settler colonialism, if you think about it, makes zero sense whatsoever. Manifest destiny is not a thing. That is not a real thing. That's a thing somebody made up one day. We all act like that's a thing. We get taught that that's a thing. This idea that somehow patriarchy is supposed to be the way that we organize our world, that's also not a thing. We all know that's not the way the world's supposed to be organized. But when we walk around, we're like, it doesn't make a lot of sense how we live here. I always say to people, settler colonialism won't even give you a house. It won't even give you the food you need to eat. It won't even give you the things you need to live every day. How can we think that makes sense? Singular person in our society that doesn't have the things that they need to be cared for, how does that make sense? So this whole system doesn't make sense. And when you start doing the things that make sense, actually the world around you responds in a really beautiful way. For instance, when you start taking dams down. When they first started doing the scientific sort of like studies about what they thought was going to happen when dams got taken down, it came from a really big place of fear, as if the dams had always been there. And the other thing I think is funny is they built these dams with no plans for like what to do with the fish. And I was like, that's how little it made sense. They built a giant concrete wall in front of fish. And they were like, that's a good idea. But I was like, and now they start talking about what it means to take it down. And they get scared. They're like, what happens? What's it going to look like? And their projections, like projections that came from scientists were always like, if we take dams down, it's going to take 50 to 100 years for that ecosystem to recover. But what you're signing up for is destroying the ecosystem as you take the dam down and having to help restore it and recover it because of what's happening in that area. And the thing I love about Native people is they were like, yeah, we know. Like you did that. That's the thing you did. Now we have to fix it. And we're willing to take 50 to 100 years to fix it. We're not going anywhere. This is where we've always lived. So yes, we understand that. Started taking down dams in various places around the world. And what they found is that the ecosystem bounces back in way less time. It's more like 10 to 15 to 20 years, if not faster. Because that's the way the land wants to be. It's what we've always needed it to be. So when we talk about land return, I think we have a lot of evidence. We have a lot of research that's been done to demonstrate that land return increases biodiversity for everyone. That much of the biodiversity that still exists in this world is already on indigenous lands. When you give lands back to indigenous peoples, they functionally restore them, not just for human beings, or Homo sapien human beings, but for our more than human relatives, all human beings that live here, our fish, our bears, our trees, our mountains. We think about all the things that we're restoring that land for. And the land that's often returned, which I think you'll notice in the land back report, is never like the functionally best land that they could return. It's land that has been scarred by colonialism, that has been taken apart by colonialism. They're then generously giving that back to tribes. And tribes are now saying, we will take on the responsibility that we have had for time and memorial to rebuild that land, to make it something that everybody can use. Land back is a movement for everyone. Now, the spaces in which I occupy include Cal Poly Humboldt. I do want to say that Cal Poly Humboldt is responsible right now for an 884-acre forest in Wiat territory that was gifted to them, although there's a whole story behind that, a couple of years ago. The first question I asked once that happened, I actually wrote a letter that said, did we ask if the Wiat tribe wanted that land? It's in Wiat territory. It's 884 acres. It includes the Jacoba Creek watershed. It also would functionally return forested land to the Wiat peoples, of which they did not at the time have any. I will say that there was a lot of fear that came out of a lot of people from this campus when I asked the question. They were like, what is she trying to do? And then I said, give it back to the Wiat. I don't know. I don't want it. I don't need to do it. And I was like, it's not even ours. We just got it. And I think this conversation has to come from a place of that it's possible, because all I kept hearing was that it would be too hard, too difficult, too much work that would have to do. What about this? What about that? And I think we have to start from a place of, let's see what we can do to make it possible. So I highly encourage you, if you're interested in something like that, like a massive land return from the university, it would be an opportunity for anybody to pick up an email right now and say, you should give the Jacoba Creek Forest back to the Wiat. Because I think there's more of us than they think. But what I like to point out to people, because after I'll give these talks, is they'll come up and they'll ask me some really key questions, and I just want to get those out of the way as we're having these kinds of conversations. The first is, well, sometimes people come up to me and be like, you want me to give, you want all the land to get given back, you want all the land to go back? And I say, yes. And I'm like, all of it? And I was like, yep. And then they go, like, you want my house? And then I'll say, yeah, I'll take your house. That sounds great. But I like to point out a couple of key things. In the United States of America, private land ownership is over 60% of the land ownership. However, when you look at the spectrum of the United States of America on the West Coast, land is primarily owned by the federal government and the state government. So a lot of lands are actually in state and federal hands already. So sometimes I'm like, I'm not really talking about you. I'm talking about the federal and state government need to think about what it would mean to really look at land returns. The second thing I'll tell people is then on top of that, there's like three families who own millions of acres of California, Oregon, and Washington. So maybe I'm only talking about those three people. And maybe we all have to sort of like start having a conversation about why do you need to own millions of acres of land when there are some tribes in California that own none? It actually should not functionally be possible for that to happen. And then what does it mean? And I'll just point this out, that one of those families is the family that donated the 884-acre forest to Cal Poly Humboldt. So when they came to me, they were like, Kutcher, why are you trying to take this forest away from Humboldt? And I was like, I'm really not. I actually think it builds a better relationship with the Wiat tribe if they own it and we work with them. But I said, I'm really done celebrating colonial institutions passing wealth to each other. And I really feel like it's time that we call them out for what it means that they keep wealth between each other and they don't think about what happened to tribes, the removal of tribes, the taking of lands, the actual walking of tribes on longest walks. So you talk about the Trail of Tears, it happened in California. It happened to tribes throughout California. There were certain instances where they gathered up tribes and they walked them off cliffs into the ocean and they had to swim back to safety. They terminated tribes illegally and took their lands from them and said, you abandoned these areas when you were terminated. The tribes had to sue to get that back. They did everything they could. They seized our lands through state and national parks. They seized them through building universities and all of that. And we're still being asked to be grateful when they want to co-manage land with us. And I'm like, we can co-manage. Why can't the tribe be the primary owner of that land? Some people tell me I'm a little bit radical. They're like, you're very radical. And then I was like, I don't know if radical is like, I think everybody should be able to have food and a house to live in. I feel like that's like the least radical thing you could say. I think we should return land that was stolen from tribes. But apparently feels very radical. So I always tell people like, I need you to sit with it. I know afterwards people will come up and they'll be like, but what about this? I often get handwritten letters sent to me in the mail, front and back, from people being like, let me tell you why you were wrong in the talk that you gave. Fair warning, if you're planning to do that, I always use it in my next talk. So I will give examples. I'm going to carefully respond to this. But I will tell you that a lot of the times people come up and what they're really kind of trying to work through is the fear that gets instilled in you as you live in a settler colonial culture that somehow everybody thinks about land management and what a country looks like and how we live together the way that settler colonialism does. Like we're all going to make sure that we build our societies in the way that we have here and not a vision where we actually live well together. And I feel like tribal peoples from the beginning were saying, we're supposed to live here together. We're supposed to find a way to be here together. Now, we're not going to join as nations. We will maintain our sovereignty, but we will share this space. And part of that is we have to maintain a relationship with each other. And that relationship has to be deeply full of trust and consistent moments where we come together to build and make that relationship possible. And that's what they were trying to do long term with their treaties, with their engagements, with the way that they helped different nations that were coming into their territories. And what happened was we get instilled with this idea that everybody would conquer, displace, and take if they could. And I don't think that that's the case. So people will ask me, like, what is it really like? So I'll say that I was there when they returned the sacred island of Tulawak to the Wiat. And I was really fortunate that they invited me to do a talk. And I was there when they were going through the process of what it looked like, because it was sort of like, what do you do? How do you actually sort of, what does it look like to return land? And I tell people the thing I recognized in that moment is that land return is actually how you experience joy. It's so full of joy. And it was probably one of the happiest rooms I've been in a number of years. And this was across the community spectrum of people. There were hundreds of people in a room together celebrating the return of this island. And it was so full of happiness and joy. So people say, like, what is land back? I'm like, it's joy. It's actually what it feels like to build community and relationship. It's actually how we're supposed to live together. And it meant for us that we were doing the work that we were supposed to be doing. It was something that we all felt an ease together in that moment. And so I want to tell people, as we talk about some of these more difficult subjects for some people, the thing I keep reminding myself is the end goal, the return, that's the moment of actual joy that we all get to experience. And that joy comes from, I think, a space of knowing that what we're returning is not just land, and it's not just wealth, and it's not just security. It's actually our return to a place that has known us since the beginning of time. It's a place that we have always been and will always be. And what I like to remind people about Tuluat is that it remembers. It remembers a world before colonialism. It knows it. It has felt it. It has seen it. And so have we. Indigenous peoples are the people who know before colonialism. It also means we know after. We know there's an after, and we're building toward what that looks like. And I think about how I listened to Cheryl Seidner, the spiritual leader of the Wiat peoples, and she was talking about how the day after the Tuluat, the massacre on Tuluat, they came and there was a woman who was still alive there, and she was stuck in the mud. And she said she was singing. That's what they said about her. She was singing. And Cheryl said she thinks she was singing a mourning song, like M-O-U-R, a mourning song. And I think about, in that moment, what it must have been like to see the destruction around you and think, I have to sing a song so that my people can go to the next world. And that's, I think, what we're doing. We're building that together. We're building a song for the future. We're building steps forward. I think we should all get excited about that. I'm looking forward to the conversations we're having today. I want to thank you all for coming. At the end of a story in Hoopoe, we say, hi, Nantik. That means, like, that's it. It's the end. But what it actually means is it, like, reaches so far. So I hope you take these moments forward, and whatever you can build in whatever communities you come from, you do that work to say the radical visionary thing out loud. Thank you so much.
That was Dr. Katja Wisling Baldy, Cal Poly Humboldt's Native American Studies Department Chair. She spoke at the Northern California Land Back Symposium 2023, a day-long gathering at Cal Poly Humboldt in Arcata on March 24. You can find videos of all sessions on the website of californiasalmon.org. Coming up, when TUC Radio returns, are highlights from the panel on University and College Land Grants, a.k.a. Land Grabs. My name is Maria Gelodin. Thank you for listening.